From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. We have a busy night ahead of us. We're going to start with Mike McIntyre. You all know Mike as a crime reporter with the Winnipeg Free Press. He's a host of a syndicated crime and punishment radio talk show Sunday nights up here in Canada. He's an author of several true crime books, including his most recent, Journey for Justice. Mike has made international news here in the last week or so where he, and you'll hear me say, unmasked a monster. The Graham James case has been something that's been talked about actually internationally for several years. Now it's a case of a former junior hockey coach convicted of sexually assaulting some of his former players, including famous NHL players like Theron Fleury, Sheldon Kennedy, and Todd Holt. And James here has been recently convicted in a Canadian court in Manitoba. Mike McIntyre's jurisdiction sentenced to 2 years. He had done a three-year sentence previous to that. But one thing James was trying to do, and one thing the lawyers were trying to do, is they were trying to protect him and his identity because he's changed a lot since the early days. Well, Mike McIntyre has unmasked that monster, and here's what Mike had to say. Okay, we're back. One of Canada's high-profile cases, or biggest high-profile cases, lately has been the Graham James case. You all know about the case. We've talked about it here. A former junior hockey coach, convicted sexual offender, and a guy by the name of Mike McIntyre. You might know him, a justice reporter with the Winnipeg Free Press, and he hosts his own crime and punishment radio show on the Ralco and Chorus radio networks. I think we've heard of him here. Has been credited with unmasking a monster. What's that all about, Mike?
Well, in Canada, unlike the U.S., mugshots, prison mugshots, are not something that are normally seen by anyone in the public. Certainly in the U.S., there's a whole industry of people right. who have benefited. There's entire websites devoted to mugshots. I'm sure we've all seen some of them. Nick Nolte's comes to mind as perhaps one of the more outrageous mugshots. And if you haven't seen Nick Nolte's, I recommend you Google it. But here in Canada, mugshots are normally off limits.
Yeah.
In the case of Graham James, you know, longtime respected former hockey coach, here's a guy who abused his trust in a most heinous way, sexually abusing many former players over a number of years in the 80s and the 90s. A couple of those players went on to play in the National Hockey League and became big stars. But Graham James was in court last week to be sentenced for his latest crimes, which had emerged. Again, these go back a couple decades now. But Graham James, his case has attracted all kinds of national attention, international attention even. And I think what really had a lot of people fuming last week, besides the two-year sentence he got that a lot of people felt was inadequate, was that Graham James, on his way in and out of court, in his past couple court appearances and in court last week because he left in handcuffs, but he took steps to conceal his identity. He had to walk right through the front door of the courthouse, but he covered his face with a balaclava or a neck warmer in two different instances. And so the public never got a chance to see what Graham James looked like. And again, this is a convicted sexual predator who all indications are remains a high risk to reoffend. And Graham James is a remarkably different looking person today than the pictures that the public has seen of him. When he committed his offenses back in the 80s, I mean, he was an extremely heavy set and certainly much younger man. Today, he's gaunt. He's, you know, he almost looks sickly, how thin he is. Just a completely different look. And so last week, after James had concealed his identity and the public had no way of seeing who this guy, you know, people wouldn't know him if they ran into him on the streets. We were able to, using some sources, get access to what normally would not be accessed, and that is a mugshot. James couldn't hide from the camera when he had to undergo his routine check-in at Stony Mountain Penitentiary in Manitoba, and so there was his mug for all to see, and it's now being widely distributed around the country. In fact, his victims, through the use of social media like Twitter, have been encouraging people to make it go viral, to spread the photo around, and it's certainly been an interesting few days, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Mike McIntyre is here, host of the Crime and Punishment radio show and a justice reporter with the Winnipeg Free Press. Mike, when the decision was being made whether or not they'd put cameras in the courtroom for the sentencing, I got to admit some of the comments that I heard, especially from the judge, almost made me lose my lunch. Let's talk about that a bit.
Yeah, and you're right. The media, not for lack of trying in this case, wanted to be able to show the face of Graham James in the courtroom and asked the judge to take a fairly unusual step, unusual certainly in Canadian courts, and allow for the courtroom to have cameras present. Just to be clear, this was not a trial. There were not going to be any witnesses. In fact, submissions were already done. This was strictly the media making an application. They wanted to be able to have a camera on the judge so that the public could, if they chose, fully hear and listen to and see the judge in her own words giving the sentence. And the media wanted to be able to have a camera on Graham James to show his reaction and obviously show what he looked like. And the argument, I thought, was quite solid by the media, and it's this. I mean, the courts are open and public places. There's nothing stopping every citizen of this country, if they want, from coming down and sitting in court. However, when I say there's nothing stopping them, there's a huge asterisk to that. Obviously, lack of space is one big deterrent. Courtrooms can only seat so many, and once a courtroom's full, nobody else can get in. And in the case of Graham James, the courtroom was full. Secondly, most people can't physically make it down. I mean, if you don't live in the city of Winnipeg, for instance, chances are you're not going to travel to Winnipeg just to take in the court appearance. People also have jobs and whatnot. So the media argument was, let's bring this case to the public. Let's open the court in a way that technically the courts are open to anyone who wants to watch, but not really in practice. So let's do that. Let's allow for a camera. It won't be intrusive. There's no witnesses to worry about, you know, the glare of the media spotlight and how it might impact their testimony. At the end of the day, though, the judge said no. Basically stuck with some of the previous precedents out there and said, well, you know, this hasn't been done before, and therefore I'm not going to create any new ground here. But certainly there was a lot of arguments, and I think people really were up in arms over this. The whole idea, and Graham James's lawyer certainly advanced this, that Graham James has suffered in an unusual way because there's been so much public attention on his case. And even in handing down her sentence last week, the judge talked about Graham James being sort of part of a big public spectacle. In fact, the judge said she doesn't want to make this case any more of a spectacle by having the cameras in the court, and talked about the undue hardship that he suffered as a result. And I think most Canadians who heard that said, boo-hoo, yeah. Graham James made his own bed and he ought to lie in it. You know, with great responsibility, as James certainly had as a high-ranking hockey coach, comes great power and great responsibility to uphold that power and to not abuse it. And Graham James abused it in the most egregious way you can.
We call it position of trust. And in this case, he misused and totally violated the trust. And to have someone who sits behind the bench worried about whether or not he will be, as far as the accused will be, it just makes you sick. But nevertheless, do you see an appeal in the sentence?
Well, I can certainly see the Crown appealing. They wanted 6 years for Graham James, and the judge gave him 2. I must admit, I'm not surprised. The sentence is about what I figured it would be. just because the offenses James was sentenced for go back, as I said, couple of decades, there's no evidence, and I mean, people can have all the suspicion they want, and I know there's a lot, but there's no evidence to suggest Graham James has reoffended in any way over the last almost 20 years. I think his most recent offense was in 1994 that this covers. So, you know, he certainly had that on his side. He also had the fact that he's previously been to prison for assaults on three other former players, for which he got 3.5 years. What he was sentenced for last week is for two other victims, but again, in that same time frame. This is not the case of a guy who went to jail, got out, and quickly went back to his old ways reoffending. If that was the case, you would be looking at a huge number. 6 years would be on the extreme low end. You'd probably be looking at double digits. But that's not the case. This is more a case of five total victims, three of which came forward in the 90s, two more waited until a couple years ago to come forward, as is their right. There's no statute of limitations in Canada. And, you know, there's no guarantee that we might not be back here in another 5 or 10 years. Maybe there's other victims out there who haven't come forward. And again, there'd be nothing to stop them from coming forward. I guess it just becomes, and this is what the judge had to balance, how much more time do you give him now? Had he been sentenced for all of these victims at one sentencing, so instead of 3.5 years in 97, which he got for three victims, by giving him two more years now, the judge is basically saying, well, now that's 5.5 years for five victims. So I think that's what had to be balanced. But I wouldn't be surprised. The Crown has a month to file an appeal, and I think this is such a highly charged political case that it wouldn't surprise me to see an appeal.
James's brother has come forward to make a comparison to Bernie Madoff, someone who takes advantage of people financially in the United States, is sentenced to, I don't know, wherever he got 400 years, and then you have a sexual monster like this that gets a couple of years. Just briefly, and I know you and I have talked about this before, Mike, let's talk about the justice system in Canada, and especially when it comes to these sorts of sexual offenses.
Yeah, it's, you know, we certainly don't walk the walk, I suppose, certainly talk the talk in terms of being tough on, you know, sex offenders and child abusers, but when push comes to shove, it seems like we often fall short of actually protecting those who need protection the most. There have been some improvements in the law. For instance, Canada is moving towards some mandatory minimums now to do away with conditional sentencings for some serious violent offenses, which would include major sexual assaults, such as the ones Graham James committed. You know, and I think a lot of that has been influenced by, there's been a huge spike in offenses involving child pornography in this country. Of course, as technology evolves, it's become a rapidly emerging crime. And so I think you've seen Parliament, you've seen the courts start to take that issue a little more seriously. I think slowly but surely, and maybe we're just talking baby steps here, that we're headed in the right direction. For instance, I covered a case last week, days after the James sentencing, where a man who sexually abused his stepdaughter over the course of many years got 6 years in prison. Now, again, a lot of people say, well, big deal, 6 years. I think to try and compare Canada to the U.S.,
yeah,
the U.S., of course, they lock up sex offenders for life and no parole. I don't think we're ever going to reach that stage, but I do think we're getting to a point where, you know, the public certainly is saying enough is enough, and I think politicians are getting there as well. And so you'll start to see longer sentences, but again, longer is going to be in the eye of the beholder, and I think there'll still be many who say no matter what, it'll never be long enough.
And, yeah, it's never long enough to rehabilitate and to try to help those victims. And it's not just about Theron Fleury, Sheldon Kennedy, or Holt. It's about all the other victims of all the other predators that are out there.
Well, that's one of the big problems with sex offenders, especially child sex offenders, is that, you know, if you subscribe to what medical experts say, there is no cure for pedophilia. You can never, fully rehabilitate a pedophile. There'll always be a risk. And so, I mean, short of locking a pedophile up and throwing away the key, whenever you let that pedophile back on the streets, there's always going to be the chance they're going to reoffend. And I guess it's a question of, do we want to continue to take that risk in this country? We've obviously seen many cases where that risk has blown up.
Absolutely. Mike McIntyre's here. Just before I let you go, I know you're waiting on the Stobie jury to come back. Interesting case, high-profile case, actually, connections to my jurisdiction and absolutely yours. Let's talk about Mark Stobie.
Mark Stobe, a former high-ranking political advisor in Saskatchewan, the province of Saskatchewan, and then later the province of Manitoba, accused of murdering his wife back in the year 2000. Stobe wasn't actually charged, though, for the killing for almost a decade. And this past in late January, his trial began. It's now been over 2 months that Stobe's been on trial. More than 80 witnesses testified, all of them giving circumstantial evidence. There's no forensic smoking gun. There's no direct eyewitness. There's a lot of evidence that points to the fact that Stobe probably killed his wife. And that's certainly the theory of police and the Crown. The question now for the jury is whether that there's enough proof beyond a reasonable doubt, as is the standard in Canada. And the jury just began deliberations on Tuesday afternoon. Who knows how long they're going to be? It might be hours, it might be days, but obviously a lot of legal eyes are looking at this case because it's unique in a lot of ways, the brutality of the murder, the time it took to lay charges, and the fact that, as the Crown said in their closing arguments last week, Mark Stobe committed the near-perfect murder. That's the words of the Crown. I guess the question is going to be that the jury will answer is, was it, if he's really guilty, was there enough sort of covered up here that he'll get away with it? Sort of shades of, I guess, O.J. in a little bit of ways, because, again, the case against O.J. was largely circumstantial, and we all know how that turned out.
Yeah, exactly. He's the host of Crime and Punishment on the Chorus and Rolco radio networks on Sundays, a justice reporter at the Winnipeg Free Press. He has a new book out, Journey for Justice. And most recently, he has unmasked a monster. Way to go, Mike. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Dana. Take care.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
And we need more Mike McIntyres out there. This isn't about Theron Fleury and Sheldon Kennedy and Todd Holt as much anymore. The monster has been unmasked. Maybe there are other victims that will come forward. The justice system now has to be looked at. Is 2 years or 6 years or 3 years or 4 years enough? Can a pedophile be cured? No way, in my opinion. And it's about guys like Mike McIntyre and those that are out there, the heroes, the victims, the Theron Fleurys and the Sheldon Kennedys, etc., and all the other victims of sexual predators that deserve our thanks and deserve our credit now because they've come forward to help someone else be protected from a monster like Graham James. I'm Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. One of the things that I can say about my, what am I doing? Just about 15 years doing this program now, or versions thereof, is every so often I come across somebody that I see early on in their career and early on in their broadcasting, and they become a part of this program. Robin Sachs has been that for many, many years. She's now a legal analyst at Fox 11 LA, of course, an attorney. She's an author, former ADA, and always welcome on this program. How you doing, kiddo?
I'm doing great, and you know what? There are a lot of people who like to pretend that they found me. And like to take credit for me, particularly one of those being Geraldo. And I will tell you that it was you, Dana Pretzer, that I got to be able to test the avenues of having an opinion and being able to experiment with what it felt like to be on top of a soapbox. And so I give you credit and thank you.
Well, I'm not looking for credit. I know what the truth is, and the truth is that you're a good friend and you've been around for a long time. And I've been watching your work at MyFox LA. And you're just getting better and better and better. And pretty soon you'll be taking over the mustache guy there, Geraldo, and doing his work for him.
Well, he's done his own work, hasn't he, with the hoodie situation this week?
Yeah. Let's talk about Trayvon Martin here a little bit. I've sent you a couple of articles. This can go several different ways, from the racial aspect to the shooting itself, how it's being covered by some in the media. Let's talk about Robin Sachs' thoughts on this case.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, I think that this was an absolutely debacle, debunked, horrific and lack of investigation. I do think that this is a case where, you know, from the face of it, it was both a combination of what looks like, you know, extreme incompetency that's unfortunately been marred with racial you know, fueled by racism and so forth, and you can't help to draw that conclusion because it was so botched early on. It's not the conclusion I would want to have. It's not the conclusion that I would, you know, that I'd like to accuse law enforcement of, but I don't know how you draw any other conclusion when at the critical moments, the critical times to do something, so many steps were missed. And, you know, if you argue about injustice and what the perps do, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, you got to argue what's good for, you know, you got to argue the bad with the good for law enforcement, too.
Robin Sachs is here. We're talking about Trayvon Martin. Some of the stories that are coming out now, and I guess we should expect them, are attacking Trayvon a little bit, the marijuana part of it. I think I sent you that article.
Yeah.
The fact that he's posted or had some Twitter posts and all that kind of stuff. But really, does that not just try to spin away from what, like Jack Webb used to say years ago, the facts are?
Right. Well, I'll tell you. I mean, I think that, you know, listen, if all of the good, the bad, the ugly of both Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin would be relevant to the case. So his, you know, prior marijuana use and his, he, you know, allegedly carrying a knife in the backpack and all those kinds of things are all, you know, technically relevant when you're making an assessment on someone, and would certainly come out in any court sort of a case or any sort of investigation. But this is the problem. There was no investigation. So to bring this stuff out now, the only person who should be at the center of this investigation at this moment is, unfortunately, that officer Zimmerman. And so, you know, if it didn't feel and smell like it was part of a PR campaign, it wouldn't be a problem. But the problem is it is part of a PR campaign. It's not part of the course of the investigation, and that's why I have a problem. And I'll tell you, if you want to conduct a PR campaign right now, law enforcement, let me give you a hint. Let's start with the words of mea culpa. We done bad. You know, I said this in Sandusky and Penn State. I mean, I'm waiting for one person in one case when they screwed up just to acknowledge it, and then you start bringing out the other stuff and it doesn't smell so poopy.
Robin Sachs is here. Check out her webpage at robinsachs.com, and of course her work at MyFoxLA. Let's get into it, and might as well talk about it, Al Sharpton, a little bit, how it's being covered. Al Sharpton is covering himself now. He's grabbed a story. He's using his soapbox, so to speak, his show, to cover him. And I think it's taking away from the tragedy of this whole case. Your thoughts from the media perspective?
Well, listen, I mean, does it surprise you? No. I mean, Al Sharpton finds his way to any story that does good for Al Sharpton, and that's what he is most concerned about. But, you know, listen, at the same time, we all do that. Whenever there's a case that's out there that we can somehow better our cause or better our image or better our soapbox, whatever it may be, you're going to take advantage of that opportunity. So it's kind of hard for me to throw daggers at him when, if I were in the same exact position and there was a case that was squarely within my you know, cause area and something that meant a lot to me, I would jump on it too. So, you know, do I wrong him for it? Do I like him? Do I like how he's doing? You know, not necessarily, but do I think that he's doing anything any different than anyone who, I mean, race is his thing. I mean, this is what he's been, that's always his thing. It's not like he's all of a sudden taking a stance on health care today because it's good for him. He's taking a stance on something that he's always taken a stance on.
Right.
So while you may not like his stance on things, the fact of the matter is it is within the area that he always advocates for. So I can't really wrong the guy for that.
How about social media? You're a Twitter, a tweeter, whatever you call it now, and we've spun that circle. And social media has grabbed a hold of this with, you're not just talking about a few thousand, but some of these celebrities are grabbing millions and millions of potential viewers. Is there a way for this to be handled fairly with social media, the way that it's being looked at right now?
Listen, I think that thank goodness for social media. If there wasn't social media, you and I probably wouldn't be talking about this case right now.
That's right.
And likewise for so many of the other cases that come across right now. So, I mean, it's because of social media that we're discussing this case and people are able to keep, you know, causes and interests alive. So will it inhibit trials and so forth? I mean, yes, but is this guy going to be facing a trial? I doubt it.
Yeah. You know, vigilantism is one thing. Neighborhood watch. I'm going to get you to put your prosecutor's hat back on. If you hear the 911 call, the 911 operator, and I'm paraphrasing, basically tells him, no, don't follow him. Don't do what you're doing. He never listened. What happened after that is hopefully the truth will come out. What about that? And what about these neighborhood watch programs, especially in the big centers where sometimes it's just plain and simple dangerous to be out there?
Listen, I mean, I think that when someone from 911, and you know how, I mean, Dana, you out of all people know how the chain of command goes. The guy decided to not listen to the orders that were given to him from a dispatch office that had a sense of the overall picture of the scene. So once that determination was made and he decided not to listen to those orders, the prosecutor would have the best and easiest case possible. He completely decided to take matters into his own hands. The problem is that now whatever prosecutors have done, they're stuck and, you know, forced to live with whatever lack of investigation that has not been done. So you can't, you know, there's 100,000 holes here for Zimmerman to hide under because there's so many questions that aren't answered. So if you can put the whole police department on trial, which I imagine the Martin family is going to do in a civil courtroom and not in a criminal courtroom, then you can really shake down the whole system. But you're not going to, at this point, I just can't see them being able to have an effective prosecution no matter what they do, even though I do believe that he should go through the rigmarole of the police being arrested.
Yeah, we talked about the media, and now we're going to talk about the politicians, the president, for example. Is it right, is it wrong, before it all comes out, for the politicians to be commenting on this case?
You know, I don't know. I'm torn on that one, I have to tell you. I mean, there was something about Obama's speech that bothered me. I mean, the fact that he, you know, personalized it to such an extent didn't necessarily sit well with me. But at the same time, listen, if you can get the president to pay attention to your case, I mean, who's going to turn that down? And obviously, it's rippled through every other person here. And if he talks about it at his dinner table, he talks about it over his morning coffee. So why shouldn't he talk about what he speaks of at his breakfast table with all of America? So I don't, you know, while I may, you know, I don't know. I just think that I can't expect him to do anything differently than what he did, considering the fact that he cares.
You and I, let's change topics for a second, and I'm sure we'll be talking more about Trayvon Martin as the days and weeks come ahead, but let's talk about Whitney Houston for a few minutes. I can think of you and I talking about Michael Jackson, Anna Nicole Smith, Heath Ledger. I can go on and on and on, these types of cases.
We have talked about all those. Those are a lot.
Yeah, we sure have. Let's talk about Whitney Houston a little bit once again. Did the media get it right? Did it get it wrong? How they covered the story.
Actually, I think the media did it just right. It was not, I mean, during the first week after Whitney Houston's death, they asked all the important questions, and I think that because of the media's presence, it forced Beverly Hills PD, who is normally somewhat of a, I don't want to call them lackadaisical, but not necessarily always thinking of, you know, criminal investigations first as opposed to whatever civil cases that may come their way. And so by having the media attention, by having the public care, by having all the people ask those questions, I think it forced Beverly Hills Police Department to at least open an investigation and look at the case. And I think that they appropriately backed off when the determinations were made.
With and I want the advocate Robin Sachs now for a minute. The young folks, I get you to put all these hats on here. You're like,
I like this.
Yeah,
I
you know,
I
don't think
I
don't think Geraldo can do this, but I certainly can because I've known you longer. So anyway, let's talk about the advocate Robin Sachs for a minute. All the people putting Whitney Houston high up on the pedestal, the role model, so to speak, and then. You know, the truth comes out that obviously her addictions got the best of her. What about that? What do we tell the young folks today about these so-called role models?
Listen, I mean, I think if there's any lesson to be learned is it's, you know, we're clearly missing the mark on the war against drugs somewhere, somehow. Yeah. we're not doing it right. I mean, here we have another person who has all of the resources, all of the support that you could possibly ask for, and she dies a young, tragic death at the hands of a combination of illicit drugs and prescription drugs. But I'm here to tell you that it just goes to show that celebrities, you know, foils and the downfalls and the stresses and the angst and all of the stuff that regular folks feel celebrities do too, and we obviously need to spend some more time figuring out how we're addressing drug and alcohol issues.
Robin Sachs's webpage, robinsachs.com. Just before I let you go, of course, there's Lindsay Lohan and her probation and all that kind of stuff. What do we expect to see from or hear from Robin on her next segment on My Fox LA?
I'll tell you, what we're going to hear is that Lindsay Lohan is going to have successfully completed her probation. She is going to, while there's lots of people out there who have been rallying against her, while she seems to not be able to get out of her own way, so long as she can eke by on these last few weeks here, we will likely see that Lindsay Lohan will be discharged with a nice big pat on the back from Judge Beth.
And you know what? Good for her. Let's hope it can hold. Robin, always a pleasure. Let's not wait so long for the next program.
Likewise. Thank you.
Take care. That's Robin Sachs, former ADA correspondent at My Fox LA. Now, when you talk about Zimmerman, and Red makes a good point here. How about the Black Panthers and the $10,000 bounty on Zimmerman? Where's that crime? And that's vigilantism at its best. And, of course, all the other race baiters and even Obama getting involved. Robin has her opinion. I agree with most of it. Some of it, you know, I don't think this is being handled fairly for sure in the Orlando area. Were there mistakes made? No doubt. Will there be more in this story in the next little while? Absolutely. And one thing I can tell you is that we'll try and cover it the best we can here. And as far as Geraldo discovering Robin Sachs, my friend, I know you're still mad at me over Drew Peterson. Take a look at the facts, my friend. Robin Sachs has been part of this program for many, many years. I'm not taking credit. I'm just telling the truth. We're going to take a break. I think that's funny. And we're going to come back with Diane Diamond talking about another high-profile case that everyone's talking about is the staff sergeant, Robert Bales in Afghanistan, and you know what happened there, and is the military getting a bad rap in the media and overseas, and what about protecting the military in defense of the military? And go to Diane Diamond's webpage; it's in the show notes to learn more of that. And I'll be really interested, for all the years that she's been in the business, her thoughts on Trayvon Martin. We'll be right back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, we're back. Another favorite guest on the program, Diane Diamond. Welcome, Diane.
Hey, nice to be with you, Dana.
Nice to have you. And for those folks listening, go to the show notes. Click on the link to see Diane's latest article on the Staff Sergeant Robert Bales. But before we get into that and in defense of the military, let's talk a little bit about Trayvon Martin and the craziness that's going on there. And I'll bet you you're going to be writing about that.
You know me too well, Dana. In fact, that is my next the topic for my next column. You know, I feel I've been a journalist for a long, long time, and in recent years I have been so frustrated with, I don't know if it's the news directors or the editors that don't give reporters enough time to really look into things, but with the Trayvon Martin case, I have noticed a complete one-sidedness in the reporting until this last weekend. You know, when I first read about this story, I thought, oh my gosh, this, you know, hot shot neighborhood crime watch guy with the gun on his hip went out and just shot this poor kid, and it's cut and dried. Well, now we're learning a lot about the other side of the story. You know, there's always two sides to the story.
Right.
And now we're hearing that this shooter, he said he shot in self-defense, George Zimmerman, had a bloody nose, blood all over his shirt. He had gashes on the back of his head. He had grass stains on his back of his shirt. There was some kind of fight there. And, of course, he now says that the kid knocked him down first, and he shot in complete self-defense. So with that in mind, I come away thinking, well, I don't know what the truth is. And it makes me mad to see people like
Al Sharpton,
yeah,
Jesse Jackson, the new Black Panther Party, putting a bounty on this man's head when the investigation isn't even complete. That's not the way our justice system is supposed to work.
No, some use the term race baiters. Even the president has come forward to give comments. And listen, there's freedom of speech. Everyone has that right to comment. But why not look at, like the late Jack Webb used to say, just the facts before you start talking? Because this is something, and you make a good point with Al Sharpton. Al Sharpton is using his soapbox, his show, to cover the story, but that story is also about Al Sharpton. So it's like Diane Diamond doing a story on herself and having it air, and that just, there's got to be some journalistic ethics here.
Well, I'm pretty proud to say that I do not watch Al Sharpton's show on MSNBC, but I used to work at MSNBC.
Right.
I used to work at NBC and the Today Show and Dateline, and why they allow a show host to interject themselves in a story, really basically changing the path of that story, is beyond me. I think the executives over at NBC should take a closer look at that, but that's just my opinion.
Yeah, and there's going to be lots to talk about, and you'll be writing about it in the near future. But what I brought you onto the show to talk about tonight is your excellent article and lots of great comments, and I encourage all the listeners to go to Diane's webpage, read the article, feel free to comment on this terrible shooting. Staff Sergeant Robert Bales, the military under attack, and because of this individual. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, you know, again, it's another case of we don't really know what happened. It happened in the far reaches of Afghanistan. 17 people are killed. We're told it's by this suddenly crazed staff sergeant named Robert Bales. But we have to keep saying, he allegedly did it. He reportedly did it. As far as I know, there's been no confession. You know, maybe he's ill. Maybe he did have a terrible head concussion, an internal brain injury. We don't know what the facts are, but I hate to admit it, but I'm old enough to remember when the Vietnam, our soldiers came back from Vietnam.
Right.
And that shameful welcome they got. It wasn't a welcome at all, as you know. And I hear the drumbeat of, oh, well, look what Sergeant Bales did. The military churns out killers. It's the military's fault. Nonsense. This was, when you look at the, you know, take a deep breath, everybody. That's what I'd like to say about all these stories. Take a deep breath, look at the facts, ma'am, and see that this is a man who had some troubles with making decisions in the past. He has run-ins with the police, never anything charged, so that if the military, I'm sure, did a background check on him, there was nothing to find.
Yeah.
There was a DUI, there was an assault charge, there was a terrible instance where he bilked an elderly couple out of their entire life savings. And he was ordered by an arbitrator, but not a court, to repay $1 million-something. And he didn't ever pay a penny back. So, you know, let's look at the person and not the institution. And, by the way, let's wait and see if he's even found guilty by this military tribunal.
Yeah, exactly. It's innocent until proven guilty. One of the big things, one of the things about this Diane Diamond is the redeployment. They're saying that this fellow should never have been sent back there. You know, your thoughts on that. There's 10 years or more this nation of the United States has been involved in wars. You know, I don't know. I think that's a pretty weak excuse.
Well, you know, he had been deployed 4 times. And this after he, the tank in which he was driving, if I have my facts right on this, was blasted, and he might have had a brain injury. But he was cleared for combat and sent back for a 4th tour. Well, you know what? There have been a lot. That sounds like an incredible amount, and it is.
Yeah.
But there have been a lot, tens of thousands, I think it's like 57,000 soldiers who have gone back for 4 tours of duty, and they didn't kill 17 people in the middle of the night in a fit of either drunkenness or rage or mental illness. So, look, I hate to say it, but I kind of wish all of our soldiers would come home like yesterday.
Sure.
I'm tired of paying for the wars. I'm tired of putting them in harm's way. But that's beyond my pay grade and everybody else's pay grade. The fact of the matter is the majority, 99.999% of our military are dedicated, patriotic warriors on behalf of all of us. And I think that's what we have to keep in mind. It's when these guys come home, when these men and women come home, we need to really welcome them. Let's not do that Vietnam thing again. That was just a shameful, shameful episode.
Absolutely. Diane Diamond's here. If you'd like to read more about that article, go to her webpage. It's links in the show notes. You talk about defining America. In fact, your quote in your email says, whatever may have happened inside the head of Sergeant Robert Bales does not define America, nor should it taint all the other U.S. soldiers still serving there. Let's expound on that a little bit.
You know, I was kind of overwhelmed. I try to post most of the comments that I get, and I haven't posted all of them yet, but I heard from a lot of military men and women, both active duty and retired, that said in effect to me, thank you so much. Thank you so much, because when one of us gets in trouble for something this terrible, we all tend to get tainted. And so thank you for saying whatever was going on in his head does not taint all of us. You know, think of the tens of thousands of Americans still serving in all over the Middle East, even in South Korea, for example. They have now a daily extra burden to prove to the local population that they're not like Sergeant Bales. Because everybody's talking about what they think they know that Sergeant Bales did. And so now the rest of the soldiers, and I heard from several of them, I put some of their comments up, you know, thank you so much, because it's hard enough to be in a theater. It's even worse if you're in theater in a combat area and you have to, you know, prove yourself over and over and over and over again to the locals that you're trying to help. So I hope my article did that.
Absolutely. Diane Diamond's here for about another 5 minutes. This social media aspect of this, Diane, and we've talked about this before, especially when it comes to cases like Bales or Trayvon Martin or whatever. It's almost taking away a little bit from mainstream media. Look at some of the Twitter accounts of the stars with 12, 15, 18, 19 million people out there. The networks would love to get those as ratings just for a newscast. What about that? Can there be a fair trial for Trayvon Martin with the social media or in that case or the Bales case? Can Zimmerman get a fair trial if arrested? Can Bales get a fair trial if arrested with social media?
You know, I really have been thinking a lot about that, especially with the George Zimmerman. You know, he admits he shot Trayvon Martin in self-defense. And, you know, the Black Panther Party, the new Black Panther Party, has a $10,000 bounty on whoever finds him and drags him in public and demands that he get arrested. Well, you know what? If we're going to rely on that kind of vigilante stuff perpetrated by social media, we're going to find George Zimmerman dragged in the city square and hung up by his neck.
Yeah.
And that's not right. That's not what we want. Now, Sergeant Bales, I think, Dana, maybe a little different, maybe even tougher, frankly, for Bales, because he'll go up before a military tribunal. And something tells me that those officers that will be sitting on that military tribunal, they ain't looking at Twitter.
No.
They're not reading their Facebook page.
I hope not.
You don't have to pull them from the public jury pool. But for George Zimmerman, if he is ever charged with anything, oh, it's going to be worse than trying to seat the Casey Anthony jury. And I was there for that. That took days and days and days.
What about blaming the police in the Zimmerman-Martin case? Usually, of course, in my background, it's always have to drop the brick on someone, and usually it's the cops. Did they drop the ball in this case? Sure, in some aspects of it. It's like blaming the military for Bales. The blame game doesn't always wash.
You know, I try mightily every time I sit down to write my weekly column to just let critical thinking take over. Now, okay, everybody says about the George Zimmerman case, well, you know, it's that law in Florida, that stand your ground law. That's why they're not charging him. That's a terrible thing. So what happened? They forced the police chief, Bill Lee, to resign.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't pass that law. Why isn't the anger at the state legislature that passed that dumb law, dumb in my opinion, dumb law, in 2005? Why is this one police chief in this one jurisdiction being forced out of what is a career job because this killing happened there? You know, it just seems to me that the anger is misplaced. If that's the stupid law in Florida, how come people weren't complaining about it before? How come this petition, Sharpton says he's got 2 million signatures on a petition calling for the arrest, why isn't that petition going to the state legislature saying, repeal that law?
Yeah.
You're not allowed to just kill somebody because you feel threatened.
Absolutely. Well said, as always. Diane's webpage is Diane Diamond, DIAMOND.com. Thank you, Diane.
Oh, my pleasure, Dana. Anytime. Have a great week.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You know, two big cases. Condolences to Trayvon Martin's family. Zimmerman, will he get ever, if he's arrested, get a fair trial? The race baiters, the Al Sharptons, the radical nitwits that are out there to grab a hold of the story and not look at the big picture. Bales, blaming the military. Bales obviously will be tried, and if found guilty, will be punished for what he did, if convicted. But it's the big picture out there that I think is the most important. Anyway, we're going to end up a few minutes early. My name's Dana Pretzer. Our website is scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can pick up the show live. You can pick up podcasts of past shows, commentaries, leave comments. And we're here for you here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll see you again real soon.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.